try that again. Good afternoon.
Hey, there we are.
So, I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we usually forget to tell you that, so we thought we'd get that out of the way early. All right, so today we're going to shift gears. I know we've had...
On We the People Radio.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, let's see. If you'd like to follow us on the chat room or ask questions online or whatever, you can do that through wethepeopleradio.us, and there's a ton of information on the webpage about our guests and the topic. I'm sure I'll add more during the show because we always talk about extra stuff. And what? Do you have anything to add?
No, I'm excited about our topic today. We're going to talk about Iran and
I know we ran into Fred and Ross yesterday, yeah, which was just a bonus.
Just a big bonus. We're going to learn about the government of Iran, the underground revolution, so to speak, that's going on over there, and what role we're playing. I mean, we got a ton of stuff to talk about.
Well, it's all been really, really current and in, you know, very much in the news. We did an interview, and I've got to link that on. It's been probably almost a year ago because I ran into Fred and Ross down in Sacramento, and I said, hey, we just interviewed a guy from your organization, the Organization of Iranian American Communities. And I think this guy, I read an article by the other fellow, and I sent him an email, and he came on with us. We learned a lot. And those guys said, well, hey, if you want to do it again, let us know. And then I forgot. I don't know. Just got busy. So I saw him yesterday. It's like, perfect. How about tomorrow? So
we had a great conversation yesterday, and the stuff we were talking about, I'm hoping we can cap on most of it today because it was super interesting, and it really shines a light on what our American government is doing to the Iranian government and how we are
and
really...
And the many mistakes we're making.
Oh, the many mistakes we're making.
Many mistakes. So let's see. I've got short bios. I have to add Fred's to the webpage, so it's not there yet. But Fred's been a human rights activist for over 30 years. He was arrested once in 1980 in the city of Mossad. It's pretty easy spelling. I think I got it right, but I could be wrong. After that, he had to leave the country and increased his human rights activity to be the voice of the people in the country. He's been active in his communities and mobilizing our community in Sacramento against Islamic fundamentalists in Iran. So for all those people that are like, well, why aren't the people? They are. They are pushing back,
they are
but
pushing
they have
back.
To leave the country in order to do it.
And being arrested in Iran is not the same as being arrested over here. Over there, if you get arrested and survive, that's like a badge of honor.
Probably makes Mexico look like a party.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Ross. Ross is a board member for the organization that I linked on the site here, the Organization of Iranian American Communities. He's a graduate of North Texas State University and a resident of Sacramento. Let's see, get to his, blah, 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 already told you that. After the fundamentalist mullahs usurping power in Iran, Ross became increasingly active in the Iranian American community projects. He has for over three decades been a successful businessman in the United States and a prominent Iranian American community leader. I've linked some of his articles, actually, on the webpage. So if you were to go to wethepeopleradio.us, you will find links to their organization, Ross's articles, their bios, and stuff like that. And I'll have the archive up this afternoon, probably pretty early. So if you want to send this show to somebody else, since there are a lot of people who could use some education on this topic, it'll be posted on there for you. You can push it out through Facebook and Twitter or email it to folks. Okay, so that's all the...
There you have it.
That's all the announcements we've got, I think. So... Fred and Ross, I don't know who's going to start. Why don't you guys tell us which one of you you are and then say a little bit so we know whose voice we're listening to.
Hello, Aaron, and hello, Bill, and thank you for your for having us today. My name is Ross Amin, and Fred is here with me.
Hi, good talking with you, and thank you so much for the chance to be able to speak about what's going on in Iran.
Well, thanks for coming on and sharing this information with our listeners. After speaking with you folks yesterday, I was pretty amazed at the mistakes we're making and the impact we're having in Iran. And that's really why I want to have you guys on here, is give us a lowdown on what's happening over there, and a little bit about yourself and some history about yourself, because I think folks would be really interested.
As you mentioned, we were active, on human rights, and we were against government of Iran and what they are doing. When I was in Texas, University of Texas, I for first time, when they took hostages, I was in the camp with in the campus with my other friends, and we were rallying against the hostage taking and government of Iran and the way they treat Americans. And so some of the agencies, they took my pictures and they sent my name to Iran. And I noticed by my family that I'm not going to be able to go back. And if I do go, they will take me, and like everybody else, they are going to execute me.
Oh.
So I decided to stay here, and I want to thank all American people for their hospitality and accepting me as a citizen. And but at the same time, I never forgot, what my people were going through, and what they have to do to just have a simple life. And I have been in contact with my relatives, my friends, in back home, and I try to be their voice.
How are your relatives being treated back there with the government knowing what your role is here in the United States?
First of all, when my father was alive, they treat him very bad. They took him to their bases a few times. They questioned him, and they gave him very, very hard time, and finally he had a heart attack because of those pressure, and he died about 16 years ago. My mother is old, and my family, they are a subject of harassment and stuff, but this is the price we have to pay to bring democracy in Iran and in the region, and peace in the region.
Because I know that our country, I'm going to say this, but I'm not sure I believe it. We think we're helping to bring democracy by, making the deal with Iran and all that. And all that is just patently false. It's just really messed up and made it more difficult for all of you, hasn't it?
That is a very good question. This is that's true. I mean, first of all, if you want to know what is it good deal or bad deal, this is a little over a year since we signed the deal with Iran. And we should know the mullahs and their mentality, their culture, what their goal is. And unfortunately, I can say that, this is not a good deal. The reason is, mullahs think that they are representatives of God on the earth, and everybody else is supposed to follow them because they are their message is coming from God. So it is really hard to talk to this kind of people with this kind of mentality. It's not hard, it's actually impossible. Right. And if we look at the fact since last year, we might limit their nuclear activities a little bit, but the ballistic missile, use of ballistic missile, and testing those missiles, and exporting terrorism, and they're active, they are increasingly active in Syria, Yemen, by supporting Houthis in Lebanon and all over Middle East, shows that they are not coming down, they are not backed down by their goal, and they are still following what they started it from beginning.
So prior to our arrangement with Iran, in which we handed over billions, they were struggling with money to fund a lot of these organizations. What's happening now that we've given them the money? Has that made an impact?
Yeah, I mean, that time, only thing that forced them to the negotiation table basically was their economic situation, their economy, because they were seriously in trouble. They did not have money to give out to terrorism like Hezbollah in Lebanon. They were behind, Iran was behind 6 months from payments to Hezbollah. So Hezbollah was in trouble, Hamas was in trouble, and also many of the Revolutionary Guards in Iran, they could not pay them on time. But as soon as we pay them the money, they all got the money, and they are able to sell oil right now. And we heard from one of the relatives that they put ad in the papers as soon as the agreement was signed, that we are hiring more Revolutionary Guard. Basically, what right. they get, anything they get, it does not go to the people. That's the mistake that some people or some officials make, and they think if they help or they give money to government of Iran, it goes to the people, which is not true. And it goes straight to exporting terrorism to Syria and to other parts of the world, you know. And they build more jails inside Iran.
And I would like, this is Fred, I would like to add one thing that since, you know, after the negotiation, actually in Iran, the number of execution in Iran is much, much more because of the Iranian government. They have more fear from the people, and therefore they need to put more pressure, especially on the young people and women in Iran. And really, the human rights issues, it has been much, much worse since last year. And then later on, I can explain to you some example of what right now they are doing inside Iran also to with more details.
Absolutely, because we were asking them yesterday, well, doesn't the government basically control the message in and out? And we need to take a really quick break, but maybe when we come back, they'll give us a little insight there. They don't have the control that they would like, which is why the West is still a threat. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Here I thought they had kind of an iron fist over the internet and all the rest of it. Apparently not. Even in Iran, you can sneak stuff through. You're listening to We the People. We'll be right back. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
I'm just a singer of simple songs. I'm not a real political man. I watch CNN, but I'm not sure I can tell you the difference in Iraq and Iran. But I know Jesus.
That's very American.
Boy, it really is.
We're a little undereducated.
Well, the only thing we know about Iraq and Iran is what our mainstream media wants us to know, and that isn't much.
Yeah. So just to kind of tie up the loose end from the part before, you guys were telling us yesterday about the information flow in and out of Iran. Because, you know, my thought is that they probably, you know, I guess I was thinking they controlled all of that, and you know, people wouldn't know what we were doing out here, so why are we such a big threat? Let people know how that really works.
You know, in Iran, the media is very much controlled by Iranian government, and also the newspaper, they're all controlled by Islamic Guard. But on the other side, you know, what's happening inside Iran, there is a lot of movement, and there are a lot of political execution in Iran. All this news is easily coming out of Iran or the inside Iran by using the internet. And there are some app program like Telegram, which the people are able to use to to pass all this information. And also, Iranian opposition, which has got a lot of members inside Iran, are able to get all this information and through the satellite we provided inside Iran. And this satellite, they are really helping all the news spread in Iran. You know, whatever that Iranian government, they're trying to cover all the execution or all the stopping any movement in Iran to bring it up to the Iranian people. And really the internet and like SMS system in Iran is helping a lot of information to be spread in Iran.
You know, yesterday you shared with us some of the stuff you have on your website. By the way, make sure you give folks that website address, because it has a lot of this information that you're talking about that the government doesn't want us to know. You've got on that website, and some of it is absolutely horrific. Let me pre-warn you, but there are things going on over there our media won't touch, but you do cover it very well on your website. And what is that website address?
Yeah, it is OIAC.org, which stands for Organizations of Iranian American Communities. And we basically have people in 43 states. We have organizations in 43 states and very, very active communities. And we are also, like you mentioned, we are involved with people in Iran and members of opposition. And we get all kind of information from them. Actually, one of the examples was on 2002, which Iran's nuclear activities was not known to the UN or to the outside world until then. And people in Iran, they exposed this to opposition organization, and opposition in 2002, they exposed it in Washington, D.C. for first time. And then from that time, all the negotiations through the, for nuclear deal started. Until then, nobody knew about it. So we get a lot of first-hand information from inside, which, like you perfectly mentioned, it's on the website, and everybody can see that.
Now, you showed us a video yesterday of a gathering of folks.
Paris.
Was it Paris? Tell us about that and how many folks showed up for that and what was covered.
Yeah, in July 9th, if you look on the Google and if you put the largest Iranian gathering in Paris, you can see them all. We had an annual meeting, which the people come from all over the world to have an annual meeting in Paris. And, of course, leadership of this organization, which is a woman, Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, she's in Paris, too. We had over 100,000 people in one place. And many members, many officials and former officials from United States came to that meeting too, such as Newt Gingrich, Tom Ridge, Michael McKenzie, former Attorney General, Ambassador John Bolton, and also we had Louis Free, FBI Director, and many of the generals, five-star generals or four-star generals, Howard Dean, Patrick Kennedy, Bill Richardson, and many others. And they all came message of solidarity and government change in Iran. And also from Senate and House, we got many video messages, like from Senator McCain, Senator Schumer, Ed Royce, Chairman of Foreign Relations in the House, Elliot Engel, and many, many others. And it was a huge meeting, and the message was free Iran and also changing government by people of Iran and their organized opposition.
So our government is quite aware of your organization. They're showing up at your rallies. Do you see the activity of our government changing with the change of administration? Do you think we'll become more involved in helping the opposition in Iran?
I think that it is because the current administrations always they are thinking of negotiating with Iran. So if they want to negotiate, they don't want to make them upset, and they ignore they somehow ignore the opposition. But if we are not involved in talking to them so much and negotiating with them, and we don't worry about negotiations so much, then we will talk to opposition, and which is legitimate opposition. They believe in a secular government. They believe in non-nuclear and, republic government. So this is the kind of people, the kind of government that people of Iran wants, and it should be supported. Basically, our opposition of Iran is strong enough to overthrow them. All they need is support, like political support. We don't need any money or any weapons, or we don't need any soldiers to go to Iran. But all we need is political support.
What we learned from our guest about a year ago, he said if we would just leave it alone, if we would just butt out, basically, that the problem would solve itself, that you guys would be able to gain control of your country again.
That's absolutely correct. Right now, the policy of Washington and the State Department is appeasing in Iran and negotiating with Iran. And really, if we remove that policy, that's just removing that policy of appeasement and just, let the people of Iran decide, then that's what happened after that. Is this human rights issues, the violation of the human rights issues in Iran is going to be more highlighted. And then based on only the human rights issues, what they're doing inside in Iran is capable to really put a lot of pressure in Iranian government. But right now, based on of appeasing mullahs, based on that policy, practically everything else is keep very quiet. Well, that is cause of a problem for Iranians.
Well, sure, because as you said earlier, you cannot negotiate with fundamentalists. It's their way or forget it. And so we have basically bowed down to that. We've given them their way. We've given them the money to
keep doing what they're doing.
And now we've made it worse. You explain it very well on your website, some of the human rights atrocities that are now taking place as a direct result of us handing over millions and millions of dollars
two sentences with some numbers. Just in case people are unaware, because I think most of us are, since January 2016, Iran has executed at least 230 people. That's at least one person per day on average. The number of executions has recently increased, and Iran ranks first in the world, followed by China, when it comes to executions per capita. They exceeded approximately 1,000 people. Sorry, 100,000. I got confused with Mao. 1,000 people in 2015. So last year alone, they executed 1,000 people. And we're talking about basic stuff. If you, I'm not going to read this whole article, but I scanned down a 17-year-old high school student. They decided that he was gay, so they hung him, a 17-year-old high school student.
Right.
So why anybody?
It's fear. It's fear-based, and this is why people have to either leave the country or operate in the shadows.
Yeah, it's not like the kid did anything.
Yeah, you'll get hung. You'll get assassinated.
So our country is all hung up on no bullying and all that. But some of the same people that are supporting that, which is predominantly our left leaning folks here, what they don't realize is all the things they support are executable offenses in Iran.
Absolutely.
So why would they support those people?
And I don't want to get off this human rights issue, but I want to go back. I want to circle back around to what you talked about with the oil in Iran. Previous to this deal, we had sanctions against Iran on oil sales, which was really crippling their ability to sanction all this terrorism around the world. Now, we've lifted those sanctions, and we talked a little bit about the numbers yesterday on what they are able to do now as a direct result of oil sales. Touch on that.
Let's let them do that right after the break. We've got to take one.
Okay, we'll take a break, but I want you to talk about the oil sales and what that revenue is really doing.
Exactly. We'll be right back. We are chatting with Fred and Ross. They are members of the Organization of Iranian American Communities. I think you'll find all this stuff super fascinating. And if you can't catch the whole show or you tuned in late, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Keep your nose out of my business.
Exactly.
Hey, we're talking about what's happening in Iran, some topics that our mainstream media won't touch, or if they do, they skip over the details.
The good stuff.
The good stuff. But we were...
Okay, back
we were,
to oil.
Yeah, we were going to talk about oil, and previous to our last great deal we made with Iran, in which we gave them millions and millions of dollars to carry on their evil deeds... We also lifted some oil sanctions, and this enabled Iran to get a oil flow going and new revenues. And tell us about what's happening with that money and how much change it's made. How much oil are they actually exporting now?
In Iran, was exporting about 800,000 barrels a day last year, and right now it has been increased to 2.5 million barrels a day they are exporting right now.
Wow.
Which is a lot of money for Iranian government.
Sure.
But I would like to mention to you that money, Iranian government is expending, for example, in Syria, the United Nations, they are estimating, there was a report from United Nations that they are estimating Iran expending around $20 billion a year helping the regime in Assad in Syria. And also, Iranian government is the main financial for the Hezbollah also, which has to pay a lot of money to them too also. Therefore, for those money, practically Iranian government is expending for their terrorism activity for that area. And as we earlier, my friend Ross mentioned, that was the point that Iranian, because they need the money, they come to the negotiation, to sit on the negotiation table. And one thing also I would like to mention also, you're talking about how many people, has been reported that has been executed in Iran. These numbers only reflect the numbers has been announced by Iranian government. And usually the numbers are a lot more than that, because...
True.
Some of the people who get executed in Iran, they don't make, the Iranian government, they won't bring their name. For example, there was a secret execution in 1986, around 30,000 people that was not announced by Iranian government. And actually, it is a very major topic these days about in that execution, secret execution in that time by Khomeini.
Yeah, the massacre that Fred is talking, it was, I make a little correction, it was 1988, and it was, they killed 30,000 people, mostly teenagers and young people, in 2 months. And actually, last a couple of weeks ago, on August 12, Washington Post has a great article regarding that massacre by Brian Murphy, which I highly recommend anybody can go and online and read that article. So, like Fred said, you know, when we have more, when they have more financial resources, they execute more, they export terrorism more. And their priority is not are not the people. You know, their priority is surviving. And they think in order to survive, they have to expand their ideology and have more countries supporting them and bring more countries together. That's why you see them in Syria, and stubbornly they are helping the Assad regime, and they are killing children, women, and everybody else in Syria with help of Russia. And in Iraq, they are in control. They have about 65,000 Revolutionary Guard in Iraq. They are supporting Houthis in Yemen. And basically, Hezbollah is controlling Lebanon.
So
as you see, they are expanding. And what these resources, financial resources, help them to hold on to those countries and keep their expansion.
Now,
if we can put a heavy sanction on Iran, you know, they won't last very long. That's why we are saying what we do here is really important. We can put a lot of pressure on government of Iran and give easier challenge to people of Iran to overthrow the government.
Now, when you mentioned Saddam, when he was in power, he was a kind of an iron fist guy as well. But when he was in power, Iran and Iraq were locked in a pretty bloody war there for a long time. When he was ousted, what changes did you see occur after we got rid of Saddam? Because we're told that that just made everything better.
That is not true, because, I mean, when Saddam was in power, Iranian government was trying to divert inside internal problems to an outside tension, war, and stuff like that. That's another reason that they took American hostages, to divert the problem. And continuation of war for 8 years with Saddam, even though Saddam, after 1 or 2 years, wanted to have a peace with Iran, but Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini didn't accept that. Until their resources dried out and they had to come to negotiation table. So Iran is basically, I mean, looking for trouble. So whether it's Saddam or no, they always look for trouble because they have internal problems. And when Saddam left, basically, and after we pulled our troop on 2009 by President Obama's order, then there was a huge vacuum in Iran, which
in Iraq,
Iran took advantage of it and took over Iraq in totally, you know.
Bill, this is Fred. I would like to mention to you, you are absolutely correct. Saddam, you know, he was a dictator, but the way it was, that's what Saddam was like, a dam stopping Islamic fundamentalism to come to that area. Because when Khomeini, he came in power, the first thing he wants to do to spread the Islamic fundamentalism. And he starts creating Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then he starts helping the Sunni group like Hamas and others in that area. And that time, the Saddam was a huge dam and not letting this Islamic fundamentalist to come to that area. By removing Saddam, which I'm not supporting Saddam, but by removing him, practically give the opportunity to the Islamic fundamentalism to start to spread in that area. and that creates a big problem, which we can see today.
Yeah, that's, and we've heard that before from other guests who are from that region, that that was a really large destabilizing force. We had also talked yesterday, I'm looking at my notes here, about immigrants and the vetting process, people coming to this country. And you guys had quite a bit of information about that. I don't know if this is the right time to do it, but we just want to make sure we don't forget to cover that part. And I know you want to talk about solutions to a lot of these things. We've got a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, we do.
Good thing we have an hour left. What do you think about the whole immigration thing?
Yeah, immigration part, like we talked yesterday, and if we were in their shoes, we had children, and they were bombing us all the time. Of course, we wanted to go somewhere else.
Sure.
That's natural. But what we have to do, when it comes to Syria, we have to support a no-fly zone area so they don't have to come out and they stay there. But when they come here, of course, we don't have enough information about them. And governments like Iran, like Assad, they try to give them a bad name. And they send some of their agents with them, along with them, to the other countries, and they create problems. So they want to stop, basically, the flow of immigrants to Europe and other places.
Well, you were
so that's the temporary solution for Syria to have a no-fly zone. But in long term, we have to force Iran and Russia to stay out of Syria and let them handle their problem and their situation. And I'm sure people of Syria do not like Assad, and they're going to overthrow him within a matter of days if he didn't have Iran and Russia back him up.
Well, you were mentioning that having a no-fly zone would really solve a lot of the immigration and refugee issues, because these folks, they don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to, you know, move to a country that knows nothing about their culture. They would rather stay where they are, but they can't. They have to get out of there. They're getting bombed every day. Their families are being killed. But you touched on the culture issue. What can you tell us about the difference in cultures when these people move to Europe or the United States, where there's no information about how they live and what their beliefs are?
Yeah, that's the way, you know. There is a cultural, you know, conflict we can see, you know, for the people who are not familiar with our system here. Therefore, I think it's not fair for them to suddenly push them, you know, from one area and then with something which really they don't want to be there, and they are pushed to be there. That's why we think in the point of cultural also is good for the people what they like to stay within that area, which is, you know, I think to have a no-fly zone in some part of Syria to these people to live with the culture who they are familiar with that, and is working for them much better than forced to come to the other countries. And that's why I think here in Washington, D.C., I hope I can see, you know, unfortunately it's not happening, I can see in the future there are some changes to the Syrian policy, and maybe they come up with the solution for all these people. Right now, we have more than 40 million people, immigrants, and this is the highest has been in any time right now. Therefore, this need to be really, this is a human right issue also, need to be more attention and better solution, instead of right now, really, I won't see any leadership in the world regarding to this problem. And you need to be more active on that.
We're gonna take another quick break here. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about ISIS and Hezbollah and how all these organizations.
How can you talk a little bit about ISIS?
Well, what's the relationship? Let's talk about the relationship between these groups and where their funding comes from, and why one day they're fighting each other and the next day they're all on the same side. So With that, we'll take a break. We'll come back
with Fred and Ross. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. These guys are representing the Organization of Iranian American Communities. You can find all that info on our website. Be right back.
It is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
We get a little crazy. No, we're never gonna survive unless we are a little crazy. Yeah, the people walking through my head. One of them's got a gun. Shoot the other one. And yet together they were friends at school.
Sounds a lot like a lot of places these days. Okay, so you were talking about ISIS before.
Yeah, we wanna
got rudely
talk
interrupted.
Talk about the relationship between ISIS, Hezbollah, these organizations that have sprung up and are at times battling with each other, and at other times they're side by side. How does that work?
Yes, that's a good question.
Good job,
when, Fred mentioned, when Saddam Hussein left, there was a vacuum which was filled by United States until 2009. On 2009, when we pulled out, there was a huge vacuum in Iraq which Iran took over. But Iran is was following like kind of sectarian policy. They were helping Shia militias and everything else against Sunnis. So Sunnis were unhappy about this situation, but they are like Sunnis are fundamentalist part of ISIS is fundamentalist section of Sunnis, and Ayatollahs are fundamentalist in Shia. But after that, when Sunnis organized their organization like ISIS, Iran took advantage of it. They worked with them, and even though they have some differences, which each one of them they believe they are represent for God, and one believes in caliphate, one believes in supreme leader. But when it comes to anti-West, anti-freedom, anti democratic movement in the area, they have a lot of common points together, you know. So that's why you correctly mentioned one time they fight each other, one time they are they're friends with each other. But I can tell you that you never seen a Revolutionary Guard killed by ISIS or an ISIS member killed by Iran. Oh. It's all propaganda. They never fought with each other, but they like to fight with United States, with the West in general, and they fight against any freedom movement in the region.
So what we're hearing over here is Russia is now making raids from Iran on ISIS. That apparently isn't true, is it?
It's not. It's not true, and even UN and all of their agencies, they mention that they are bombing opposition of Syria, opposition of Assad, and they are not fighting ISIS, basically. What the numbers are for ISIS, they estimate from 10,000 to 30,000 members for ISIS, which is not a lot in a big area like this. And if you look at it, their bases mainly are in the countries that they are controlled by Iran, like mainly Syria and Iraq. And basically they have a safe place, you know, as long as Iran is controlling them.
What you're saying is the Iranian government is supporting ISIS.
They are kind of, they are waiting on the side, and they are not harming them, they are not fighting them. As long as they are the threat to West, and they can, even they do have some conflict or some killing that Iran does, and then they blame it on ISIS. So they make it really bigger than what it is. But if there is no government like Iran to give them a safe haven in those two countries, I don't think that they can survive.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, I would like to mention, like for example, on May 21st this year, the leader of Taliban, his name was Mullah Muhammad Mansour, he was visiting Iran for a month. And then when he was going back from Iran, going back to Afghanistan, at the border of Iran and Pakistan, he was killed.
Huh.
And, you know, a lot of people, they didn't know what's going on, why the leader of the Taliban, you know, is in Iran. But because he was killed, it came on the news. These are the connection, you know, we can see, even though Taliban, they are Sunni, but you will see financially, they are getting support from Iranian government.
All right, we're
constantly go to Iran.
We're going to get cut off by the news here.
And coming back.
Okay, let's pick that up. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be back in 5 minutes, and I want to talk more about that.
Yeah, because that is super interesting. We appreciate your information. We'll be right back with Fred and Ross. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Afternoon. You are joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And if all three of us aren't here, it's not really We the People. It's sort of We Are Pretending, which is what we'll be doing next week. Aren't we having We Are Pretending next week, Bob? You're gone, right?
At this point, yes.
Oh, well, so it's up for grabs. So we'll see. We'll see who we have next week and what's going on there. So we're being joined by Ross and Fred, and I was trying to pull my page up here so I have my information in front of me. Ta-da. And they are both activists, basically, with the Organization of Iranian American Communities. And we've been talking in the first hour about all sorts of stuff, oil and Syria and human rights. The human rights stuff is really big. I hope that you will take a moment and go to their website. It's oiac.org. And if you forget, just go to our site. It's linked on there for you. But before we were so rudely interrupted, we had to rudely interrupt Fred again. Sorry, Fred. Continue your thought.
Yeah, we were talking about the ties with the Taliban and Iran and some recent events.
Sure, yeah, and I have another example which easily you can access, you know, internet, is regarding to the leaders of the Al-Qaeda. They are living in Iran, in Karaj. And actually, even the State Department, in one of the reports, they mentioned that they are in Iran, the leadership. And also from there, they are also organizing crime in the other countries too also. Therefore, really, the problem I will see with the line of appeasement, what the United States is with the Iran line of appeasement, practically with that concept is not covering this kind of reports, because they're hoping that the behavior of Iranian government and Islamic fundamentalism may change. And as we have seen through the history, you know, for last 30 years, this is not working. And this policy, you know, is not working because Iranian government, they have done so many crime in that area that they are not capable of this kind of change. And if they want to do that, they know they are going to be overthrown by the people very, very fast.
Now, the events that are taking place in Turkey, and I think today there was another bombing there, This is all being backed by Iran, isn't it?
Some of it is. Some of it is by ISIS, but and some of it is the problem between the government of Turkey and Kurds, which, by the way, sometimes government of Turkey, they use ISIS as an excuse to go inside the Iraq or Syria to bomb or kill Kurdish people. So they have differences, a lot of problems since years ago. A lot of Kurds, they are not allowed to have a Kurdish name, or they talk to their language inside Turkey. So they are limited a lot. So Turkey uses this as an excuse, but in general, like we said before, Iran likes to expand its fundamentalist ideas in the whole region and eventually in the whole world. And they openly mentioned many times that they want to put their flags on White House. So there is no limit where they want to go, what they want to do. They are trying this terrorist activities everywhere. And as long as we give them ransom and we give them, we legitimize them by talking to them, sitting at the same table with them, they are going to continue doing that. What I mean is we don't talk with Al-Qaeda's leadership or ISIS leadership, but why we talk to Iran, why we sit down and legitimize them, I don't understand.
Now, we're being told that by our administration that ISIS is basically on the run, and we're actually winning that battle against them, and their numbers are dwindling. Is that true?
There is no accurate number, but I can tell you they are not. They don't have, like, they run everywhere. They are free to be in Syria and Iraq and a little bit on other parts of the world, and they have no problem in that area.
They can move as freely as they like.
Exactly.
I think our policy in Middle East is not working.
Yeah.
And based on when the policy is not working, how they could be on run practically. We need to have a changing our policy in that area. And without any major change, I mean, we are not going to be on the winning side at all.
Yeah, it seems like all of the things that we've done. I guess maybe it's a better question. When was the last time we had a decent policy over there? Did we ever? Were we ever going the right direction?
You know, we have one, I think, my opinion is that the sources, information we are getting from Middle East is not from the good sources. And when the State Department, in my opinion, is when, you know, when we are not getting good sources sometimes, then we are object to make a mistake in our policy.
Yeah, we
and
talked
I
about
think
that.
That's the root of the problem you're having.
Yeah, we talked about that yesterday. That the information in our U.S. intelligence community is basically getting their intelligence from the cheapest guy over there, whoever they can give money to. And you were saying that
you give
people money and they'll tell you whatever you want to hear.
Really?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely. That's what we see as a problem. When you don't have a good sources of information, it's very hard to do the good analysis.
Yeah. In Iraq war, we were relying on Chalabi's information, which was at the same time the agent of Iran, and we were using his information in UN and in Congress, in Senate, everywhere. And now, after that, Iran is using very complex system, spreading the news everywhere and lying about things. And they have been successful, unfortunately.
Now, how do we get accurate information that we can trust out of Iran and out of a government basically that's they're criminals? How do we go over there and get information from such a closed, tight society?
That's a good question, Bill. this is where we have to have dialogue with opposition. You know, like since 30, 40 years, 37 years ago, anything opposition said has been true, including information regarding nuclear activities, Iran's nuclear activities. So we should dialogue with the opposition too, and then we can, I'm not saying to 100% accept anything, but at least we can compare them and we can verify that which source is true. But as long as we deal only with mullahs and we sit down and negotiate with them, we are getting those kind of information, and we are not investing on real news or real information.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know, me and Russ, we are not against the negotiation. You know, negotiation is good, but if it is working.
Right.
But when it's not working, we need to come up with a result and conclusion that really is not working. And, you know, based on your question also, the Iranian people, they have been the first victims of this Islamic fundamentalist in that area. And, you know, Khomeini, he executed more than 100,000 of them to take power in Iran. And practically, when Khomeini, he came in power in Iran, he closed all the universities for 2.5 years in Iran because he said, these people in university, the students, they are pro-West, we don't need them. Therefore, we have a huge challenge against this Islamic fundamentalism since Khomeini, he came in power in that area. Therefore, these people, you know, with like the gathering we had in Paris, is exposed so much information. What is the option we have? How to handle this Islamic fundamentalism? And I think this Paris will get a lot of attention, and a lot of people are coming to that meeting because they will see the solution, how to resist this Islamic fundamentalism and how to arrange and how to organize to get the better, you know, to get to the Middle East to solve the problem.
What, as far as the resistance in Iran goes, you know, the United States has recently, maybe not so recently, had a reputation of always supporting the wrong side over there and just making a bigger mess of things. What is the resistance attitude towards Israel? We haven't really talked about that.
Hmm.
Yeah, as far as resistance, we have a statement from the National Council of Resistance of Iran, which is a coalition of many different organizations, which biggest one is PMOI, or Mujahideen of Iran. They have a statement regarding a two-state solution for the Middle East. But beyond that, we think that it's between people of both countries to come to the solution, and we really believe in peace and in Middle East.
Yeah, because I'm curious. We know we want to talk some about solutions, and I guess by way of getting to that topic, I'm curious if you could about what it would look like if the opposition was running Iran versus what's happening now.
I mean, you know, that's a good question. I'll go back to Israel. That's the situation. We are not going to have, you know, Iran is not there for in that future. It's not going to support Hamas or all the Jihad Islami, all those radical groups, you know.
Oh, that'd be a nice change.
To solve the Israel and Middle East problem, I think we need to defeat this Islamic fundamentalism in that area. And that's why, you know, we're going to have a peace in that area. You know, if you look at it before Khomeini come in power in Iran, there was no any major conflict between Shia or Sunni, or we didn't have this Islamic fundamentalism before. Therefore, if we solve the root, if we get rid of the root of the problem in that area from where it started, therefore, I think it's going to bring peace in that area. And also, the Iranian opposition, they do believe to the non-nuclear Iran and Democratic Republican, which is going to be a very good sample for that area to spread and to get to the democracy to that area.
Isn't that...
You have it on your website when it's OYA goals. If you go to the bottom of that paragraph, you see click here, and it's 10 principles point from Mrs. Rajavi. And if you look at that, it says the difference between these two governments is totally different. Is the opposition believes in secular government, freedom of religion, separation of church and state, freedom of woman, and all those 10 points, if you look at it, it's really impressing that, you know, in Middle East, some anti-fundamentalist organization believe in those, which is similar to what we believe in United States and our Constitution is. So basically, it's totally different, and there is no comparison between these two.
How would that be any different than when the Shah was running things over there?
Hold on, that's going to be a long answer.
Oh, okay. We'll grab that on the back.
I was like, wait a second, we can't do that and have a break at the same time.
All right.
We'll be right back. We say that all the time. We'll just be right back. It's just too bad you weren't with us yesterday when we talked to Fred and Ross for like hours and learned all sorts of good stuff. You know, I'm sure you finally figured out you should have been there. We'll be right back and do what we can for you in the last 40 minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Right on.
Okay, in the break, I tried to be productive here. So I was looking at the 10-point plan for the future of Iran since, you know, we're looking on the solution side. And one thing caught my eye. In number 6, we believe in the rule of law and justice. We want to set up a modern judicial system based on the principles of innocence, the right to defense. I mean, all these things would be really seriously revolutionary. And it says here that the mullah's Sharia law will be abolished. So that's abolishable? I mean, they can get rid of that? Don't you have to have that? Or
no, basically most of the Sharia law is not really, we don't believe it came from Quran or Muhammad. It just, during the time, it just they build up and they add that and they came up with this, and majority of the Muslims do not believe in those Sharia laws. It's just fundamentalist people that they try to force it, and they force other people to follow it.
Nice. So when you see in this country that they're, you know, or in England, different places where they're setting up Sharia courts, you guys just shake your head and, you know, secretly mutter that these people are idiots under your breath, or...
Exactly.
This is a very good topic, which we cannot have a Sharia law. Sharia law is made, after Islam, the people, they made their own law based on their own interests over the century and century, and not they're calling Sharia law. But if you check one by one, you will see you cannot find anything to back up those laws, practically. Therefore, the Sharia law, should not be there.
No,
we just did a whole show on it last week. And so I guess the confusing question is, it sort of looks like in order to be a good Muslim, you have to believe in Sharia law. But I guess that's not true.
No, that's not true.
Nice.
That's not true. Unfortunately, this has been for years and years has been spread by those like in Iranian mullahs or from the other Sunni side for their mullahs and for their own power. And practically, to keep them as a religion leaders for their area, and that need to be changed.
Yeah, obviously.
Before Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, In no countries, nobody was talking about Sharia law. Basically, they all came to the surface after he came to power, and they spread that culture and those stuff, kind of laws. Plus, you know, we, like I said, we believe in separation of church and state, and because everybody in the country is not same religion, so we cannot have same Sharia law enforced in the country. And Iran has basically a very, very good history of cultural and secularism since 5,000 years ago. And if you look at the Persian New Year, it is on first day of spring, and the reason for that is they don't want any religion to be offended or feel that this is not their ceremony or this is not their New Year. So they went based on nature, not based on religion. And before Ayatollah came to power, we were friends with Christians, Jews, Baha'is, and we were going all in same schools. We had no problem. And I can say before revolution, the biggest Jewish population in Middle East or in the world after Israel was Iran. So, but after revolution, many of them unfortunately had to leave the country to other places because of threat from mullah. Same thing with Christians, same thing with Baha'is, and also moderate Muslims had to leave the country, many of them.
So before the Ayatollah came into power, you had the Shah. It seemed to me at that time there was a lot less unrest in the region, but they still threw him out and elected to go with...
Because the time for the one person ruling the country is over, basically. Shah was one family, one person, basically, was ruling the country, and toward the end, you know, it was more tension. He was telling people that if somebody is not agree with me, they can take their passport and leave the country, and stuff like that, which people were not happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to make changes, and Ayatollah Khomeini came and talked very good about, he promised many things, but he never delivered. But anyways, people wanted to change it. But I tell you one thing, you know, in dictatorship, because there is no freedom, there is no political parties, people are not educated with the new system. So when they are overthrown, there is a little chaos there because, like I said, people are not educated. They were not able to talk about anything prior to that. And, of course, there is no organization. But now, with the help of media and help of satellites and everything else, fortunately, in Iran, there is a strong opposition. So this time is not going to be like that time. But, again, ruling one person, whether it's Shah or Shah's dictatorship or Ayatollah's dictatorship, is over.
Yeah, because that was going to be my next question, is they didn't like the dictatorship of the Shah, so they brought in the Ayatollah, who was in exile and made a lot of promises, and it turned out he was probably worse than the Shah was, and now they're kind of sorry they went that route. So you think they've learned that now they have a shot at a true democracy?
Kind of a balance.
You know, the Iranian people has been through this religion abuse by Iranian government for a long time. Therefore, that will give them a good experience to know how important to have a secular government. I think what have done Khomeini, you know, he came and he used the revolution and he you know, he established his dictatorship in Iran. But because of the Iranian people are suffering for a long time, for him, they learn a lot that that if change coming need to be, you know, secular government, and you know the ideology should be, you know, keep separate than the government. And I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah, Bill, you are right about, you know, Ayatollah being 100 times worse than Shah, but it doesn't make Shah a good person or good system or not a dictator. Like Fred said, you know, they learn the lessons that either one of those dictators doesn't work. It has to be Republican, and it has to be the leader of the country has to be chosen by people exactly the way we do it here.
Yeah, that's the only way. I mean, once you start killing all your citizens and trying to silence everybody and all that, it's like, there's really no coming back from that.
No, there's not. But, gosh, you know, they haven't had the experience of this type of government over there, and I think that's what, that's why it fails. I think they get scared of a republic. And they always end up having another revolution. Just about the time they get it off the ground, they revolt and go back to what they know.
During the Shah, you know, Shah killed many leaders in the country because he felt they are a threat to him. So there was not a strong leadership at that time. But right now, with the leadership of Mrs. Rajavi, we have a strong leadership, and we have a lot of support, and it's totally different with the last time.
Well, that's good to know. And so the people, I'm always kind of curious what will happen. Okay, so let's say just, you know, it works. The opposition works. You get rid of the bad guys. You've installed a basically democratic system. Would people who have lived here, like guys like you that have been here for like 30 years, would they turn around and go back to Iran? How many? I mean, I know you can't give me a head count, but would most people go back or would they stay here?
Like you said, it's hard to tell because many of us, we have our children born here.
Sure.
They are raised here, so if they go back, they don't know what to do. So we can go back and forth, and maybe some people decide to go back. I do not know. It depends, you know, how good Iran becomes, which I'm pretty sure it will be a lot better than what it is now.
Would you ever feel truly safe going back, knowing that, you know, you have a little target on your back?
Not now. Not right now. If we go, definitely we don't. Past the airport, they take us from airport to the jail. But hopefully, when it's changed, we'll love to go back and visit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Going back and forth, we need to take a really quick break, and we will be right back. You told us a story yesterday of someone who spoke out. I'd like you to maybe tell us that again. Someone who spoke out, but they did it before they got their family out. I don't think people realize the cost of these types of changes on people. We are speaking with Ross and Fred. They are from, they're not from, they're from Sacramento, actually. But they are with, I should say, the Organization of Iranian American Communities. You can find information about that at oiac.org or on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Okay, Ross and Fred, let's scurry on to solutions. I know you guys did want to cover that.
Yeah, we talked yesterday a little bit about solutions, and I thought it was interesting. One of the things you said was you don't want foreign troops. You don't want military support. What can we do?
Yeah, like you said, a lot of people here, they think when we are talking about the change of government in Iran, we are talking about military action. But that's not what we want. It's not possible, and I don't think people of Iran like that too. But also the appeasing mullahs and sitting down with them and talking to them, legitimizing them is not a good sign either. We should be on the side of people, and like you mentioned earlier, we should be on the good side, you know, the side of, you know, people. But what we believe is that we call it third option, and that is to talking and negotiating with opposition and recognizing opposition and do not deal with Iran. In other words, we shouldn't pay them money, we shouldn't deal with them, so it makes them weaker, and it makes easier for people of Iran to overthrow them. And that's basically that's all we want. We don't want any money, we don't want any weapons or nothing else, just recognition, and that's it.
How do the people overthrow a government that has a military? They're not going to go out quietly. How would that work? What would it look like?
Yeah, the level of support in Iran for mullahs is extremely low. Like in 2008 and 2009 uprising, even mullahs didn't have enough military people to stand in front of people. So they brought many people, many army. People from Syria and from Iraq by Maliki and Assad. So in a case, each one of them have trouble, they help each other. At this time, Iraq and Syria, because of their own problem, they are not able to send troops like 2008 and 2009 to help them out. So we think the level of support for mullahs is so low that doesn't matter how strong their military is, they are not able to confront people. Same thing happened during the Shah. He has one of the biggest military biggest one in the region, and one of the biggest in the world. But when people came to the street, and they could not do anything about it, and they fall in like few months.
So you don't feel the military in Iran will support the mullahs?
They do, but not in a bigger scale, you know, like if they see people coming to a street, because many people who work for military, they do it because they don't have job.
You know, in Iran, the Arabs, the Kurds, the Turks, the women, the student, teacher, worker factories, you're talking about everybody is almost, you know, all the group, they don't like this government. And they're all united against this law of the supreme leaders. Therefore, in 8 years ago, when people that saw witness within the Iranian government, they came out on the street.
and they make the movement. But right now, these people, they are not in the point of economy. They are not in the better situation compared to 8 years ago. And they are much, much, much worse situation. Therefore, once they find the situation is right, they will be ready again. At the same time, Iranian opposition is very important to be organized inside Iran for that time and to be ready for that. Because we know the Iranian government, they are organized too. Their military have a military, they have a Basij, they have Islamic Guard, and it's not going to be easy. But as much the Iranian opposition is more organized and ready to help the people during the uprising, easier will be, you know, and will be more hope also for that.
How much influence does the Muslim Brotherhood have with the opposition?
I'm sorry, the local brotherhood?
No, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh, Muslim Brotherhood mainly was in Egypt. And they, of course, when Morsi was in Egypt, they had a better relationship. But since then, they don't have a good relationship with Iran at this time.
Okay, so they don't have a good relationship with the opposition in Iran either?
No,
they don't have any.
They are fundamentalist. Opposition of Iran is basically moderate. You know?
Okay.
We believe if any organization in that area, if you're soft on this Islamic fundamentalism, is going to hurt your organization and you cannot survive. You have to be really have a good red line against this Islamic fundamentalism. Otherwise, you cannot survive in that area.
Okay.
Interesting. We have someone in the chat room wanted to know, what could Americans do to help out?
That's a very good question. Great question. What we do is, like I said, you know, the on 2008, when President Obama unfortunately said to Ahmadinejad, if you open your fist, we shake your hand, and this had a huge effect on Iranian people. They thought they took it as a support for government of Iran. But on the other side, when members of Congress or Senate, they come and they send letter against government of Iran and they talk about human rights, it encourages people because they see they have a voice in there. And like we mentioned earlier before, there are some apps that people in Iran use and satellites. So every time a member of Congress, Senate, or officials, they support people of Iran and human rights, they encourage a lot. So what we can do, we can call members of Congress and ask them to join. Some of them, they are already starting to work on the campaign of change government of Iran by people of Iran. And if they are a big voice in the Senate and Congress, we can, it helps us a lot. And of course, since we are broadcasting everything over Iran through our satellite, then which is the most watched TV in Iran or satellite, they know when members of Congress, Senate, and other officials, they support them. Also, we are going to have the big rally in New York on this September 20th, when President Rouhani is coming and to UN, and we are trying to say he's not representative Iranian people, and he's representative of Ayatollah Khamenei, which is supreme leader, and we criticize him being in the UN, and anybody in that East Coast can join us, that would be great. But the best you can do is call your representative and senators and ask them to join this campaign.
Nice. I think that's really important. It's important for Americans to figure this out, because we can only hide behind our ignorance so long. I mean, there comes a point in time where, you know, we need to get with the program.
Yeah, one thing, next step, I think, for us in the USA is to highlight the abuse of human rights in Iran. And also, because this is the weakness of Iranian government, you know, if they back up from human rights issues, they cannot survive. Therefore, if you put more pressure regarding those, this execution and human rights in Iran, therefore, it really help. And if we can call our representative and ask them, you know, to add new sanctions against the human rights abuse in Iran, I think that would be a good direction also, too.
So I guess it's safe to say that the opposition in Iran is not a big fan of our president.
I like the laughing. The laughing is
like
good.
We like to work with every president, and we like to... What we are doing, basically, is not only for people of Iran. It's also for people of United States. Because, like you mentioned correctly earlier, we are making mistake after mistake, and if we don't mistake, we make those mistakes. If we are able, our organization is able to correct those mistakes with the help of our American people, our American friends, then we can avoid a lot of expense, a lot of wars, and a lot of tension.
Let me ask you this.
You know, one thing I believe is that when Iranian government, they're forced to come on negotiation table, we could have a better deal. In that time, you know, if we could have a mullahs deal, we could control these mullahs better. Unfortunately, we didn't have a good deal in that time, very strong deal. Therefore, I think that's why this problem is coming back and coming back again. Therefore, I wish we have a stronger president, you know, to see the reality of the there is no change of behavior of Iranian government and be more realistic.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk about...
Final thoughts.
Yeah, final thoughts, and also your organization's involvement in our American politics. Do you guys do that? Do you
want good
to
idea.
That? But we'll talk about that when we come back.
All righty. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back. This one is just for laughs, isn't it? And we keep doing that, and it's not helping.
No.
So we have to stop doing that. Either that or maybe we need to target it. Just get the mullahs. Could you even get rid of the mullahs, Ross and Fred? Could you actually get rid of the mullahs? Is that possible?
Yes, it is possible.
I mean, are there just a zillion of them? Are there 5 or 50 or...
We think they don't have, like I said, they don't have support of the people. That's why they are trying to expand and have some ground outside of Iran between fundamentalists in the region. We believe the majority, like over 90% of people, they want government change in Iran. And we try, as a good citizen, we try to... bring our experience and our knowledge about Middle East on the table and make sure our politicians, they understand what they are doing and what the solution is. That's our goal is. So it benefits people of Iran, people of the region, and especially people of United States, like I said, because we don't have to pay for another war or we don't have to send our lovely youth to war to get killed or wounded. So we think, and we have been very successful as far as having support in the Congress and Senate in a bipartisan bipartisan way, and we can use a lot of help from our American friends to get this going to the right direction and have a right policy in Washington.
And get the facts out. I mean, I guess that's why we thought this was so important to do with you, is so we could get some factual information out for people.
How big is your organization over here in this country, and how active are you in politics in the United States?
We had some resolutions that basically we had majority of House co-sponsoring it. So you can see how widespread our organization is. We are active in 43 states. And we have great grassroots activities, and we have, like I said, many supports, and we still have a lot of support. But we can make it stronger so we can do it faster. But like I said, you know, we have rallies in Washington or D.C. up to 20,000, and we had in Paris, we had over 100,000. So you can imagine, this is considering people who come to these rallies or join us, they are accepting a lot of threats and a lot of, they have to pay a lot of prices for it.
Sure.
Because of government of Iran. And if we didn't have that fear, you know, we could have a lot more people, you know, joining us, and we had a lot of bigger demonstration and stuff like that.
Well, because
we do have a lot of activities in the House and Senate, and this is all because of we have so many supporters everywhere in the United States.
Okay, so two questions. One is kind of simple. On your website, it says, you know, there's a join button. So basically to join OIAC, do you have to be Iranian?
No, you don't.
I kind of thought not, but I thought I better ask.
No, this is not only for Iranian. That's why in English, too. So,
sure.
This is, like I said, our goal is to bring the facts and show the right policy toward Iran and Middle East and how to fight fundamentalists like Ayatollahs and ISIS. So this is basically, we want everybody's help.
Good. So OIAC... .org is a great way for people to get accurate information from the people who really want to save Iran from that moment itself.
That's correct.
What was the other thing I was thinking of, too? Oh, you had mentioned real quickly, we've got probably like a minute and a half, but you had mentioned that there are people who speak out against the current regime, but if they do that before they get their families out, nothing good happens.
Yes, you know, that's a good example. Shahram Amiri was a famous scientist in Iran, and a nuclear scientist in Iran, and he left Iran, and he came to the United States. But the Islamic Guard, they went to his family, his kids, and his wife, and they arrested him, and they put a lot of pressure on him to bring him back. And then when he came back in Iran, the next day they arrested him, and then after 1 year, his name Shahram Amiri, after 1 year, they did execute him. Therefore, you know, we, as the experience we have with the Iranian government, you know, therefore I think it's better first you move your family out of Iran and then come out of Iran, because, and otherwise the Iranian family, they use your family as a hostage to bring you back to Iran. And
right.
That's what you were trying to mention yesterday.
Did they kill?
In our organization, we have so many cases that the people, they have to pay a big price because of they came first and they got their family and they put in a prison.
Did they kill that guy's family anyway?
Not the family. They didn't kill that family, but they used their family. They put him in prison, and
sure.
they constantly called Shahram Amiri in the USA, and the family, they begged him, you know, please come back, you will be fine. The Iranian government is telling us if your husband come back or the father come back, nothing will happen to him. And then he went back to Iran, and then they execute him after that.
Lovely.
What's the, give us real quick, the dates of the rallies coming up?
It's September 20th in front of UN, and we expect 15 to 20,000 people there. And if anybody can join, or they have friends or relatives on East Coast in New York, if they join us, that would be great.
All right, fellas, thank you very much for coming on today.
And their website is oiac.org. You can find all their information and contact information, stuff like that. If you'd like to get back to them with us, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much for giving us the chance to speak about all these issues.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Thank you. Our pleasure.